Good morning, everyone.
Oh, my mistake. I messed that up. Sorry.
It's okay. After a short respite, we have returned to Block Talk Radio, at least for the time being, and happy to be back. This is Jeffrey Swartz with my compatriot, Brendan Berry. We are both professors of law at WMU Cooley Law School. And before we go any further, I would like to, do the disclaimer that we always do, and that is that what Brendan and I espouse and the opinions that we give to you are ours and ours only. They are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of WMU Cooley Law School, its faculty at large or as individuals. And good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Jeff. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. How you doing, Allergy Man? Everything okay?
I'm doing okay, yeah. Okay.
You're hanging in there?
I'd say terrific, fabulous, but then I'd be lying. So, yeah, I'm okay.
poor Brendan. He's the guy that when you're moving, you need to call because he's like moved three houses in the last week.
Really?
He worked really hard. He moved a friend of his moved down from Michigan, helped move him into his house. Then he sold his house and moved it to somewhere else. His brother, mm-hmm. who was living with him, has moved into his own place. And he's still in the process of finishing that move, but he's been working very hard. I mean, this is, this is like exercise.
And that's not good. We all know that that's not a good thing.
That's not in your repertoire. Okay.
No.
Well, I got to ask you, Brendan. So are you like a 6-footer and you're like solid muscle? Is that where, that's where all that comes from? All that?
No,
yeah,
I'm 5 foot. Yeah, I'm
no,
5 foot
him.
Nine
that's
of flab.
Definitely him.
5 foot nine of nothing but flab. That's me. And,
but you got to give him credit. How much have you lost, Brendan? How much
70 pounds.
Have you lost?
70
okay,
pounds.
So yeah. You got to give him credit
God
for that. I mean,
you.
he's the king of keto.
Yeah, that's right. You do a show on keto.
I got to admire that. I only lost 50 pounds, so you're way ahead of me. I'm down
man.
At 200.
He's the king of keto, not the guy that testified in OJ's case, the diet.
Was his name Keto?
I thought it was.
I guess it was.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, something like that.
Close enough for government work, and I was a government employee.
And we're showing our age now, by the way, that we can, reach back to the OJ trial and know the characters, right?
I just thought it just kind of fit in. Now that we try to start every single show with some sort of laugh and yuck. And we've managed to do that again. But the first segments that we do of this show is our ability to say what we really think. And the two that Brendan and I are going to talk about are kind of tied together. My attitude is that I want to talk about Mark Meadows. And I have a feeling that we're going to hear something about Mr. Lennon Bannon in Brendan's segment. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about Mark Meadows because I think that he has been underestimated his entire career for what a con man he is. I think he has been underestimated for what a duplicitous person he is. I think that he has hidden... He's been there. People have recognized what he is, and somehow it has slid off of him like slime off of a ghost in Ghostbusters. Yeah. And so I really have some very strong feelings about him now. I think that the worst thing he ever did was try to seek Elijah Cummings' assistance when he was called a racist during the Russian interference hearings in the House. And really took advantage of a really kind, caring, dedicated public servant to try to get off the schneid of being called a racist. Mark Meadows has made it abundantly clear he is that. He is a racist. He has always been a racist. He has always backed racist thought processes. He's never come right out and said what he is, but he has shown it in his career in the House. And I don't want to hear him talk about his adopted granddaughter of color. I really don't want him using her as cover for the person that he really is. Because the person that he really is and what people are starting to find out about him and starting to really realize about him will be a shame upon his family for the next two generations. Mark Meadows, as much as we look at people like Steve Bannon and we look at Stephen Miller and we look at Donald Trump and we talk about how bad they were and how they orchestrated things, nobody orchestrated January 6th quite like Mark Meadows. He was the point man. He was the organizer. He was the guy who made phone calls. He was the guy who dealt with the Department of Justice and tried to hardball them. He was right by Donald's side through all of this. He's the guy that made Donald aware of what could happen if there was violence. Now, we're not talking about the Eastman memo. We're talking about a memo that was prepared by a lawyer last name of Ellis who worked for the Trump campaign, who literally took Eastman's memo and brought it to life and sent that memorandum to Mark Meadows, who then forwarded to the President of the United States, the then president. And he, from that point on, attempted to carry out what was in that memo. He was there with Trump all through January 6th. He took notes. And he is hiding. Mark Meadows, listen to me carefully if you are listening. You will go, when everything is said and done, you will go down as history as the Benedict Arnold, the guy who turned on a country that you supposedly cared about. You're going to be the guy that your ancestors, not your ancestors, your the generations beyond you will change their name rather than have people ask, are you related to Mark Meadows? That's going to be your legacy. You're hiding, but you can't hide for long. Those memos, those written notes are going to come out. And what you were on January 6th will become abundantly clear. And you don't have the money to fight the legal battles that you need to fight. If you're scared that what's going to happen to you is the same that happened to Steve Bannon, you should be afraid. You're target number one right now. You have a bullseye on your back, and the Department of Justice is going to hit that bullseye. You're going to jail. And if you think you can hide behind the Fifth Amendment, you can't. Because the minute you assert your Fifth Amendment rights, the committee is going to give you use immunity. And you will be commanded to answer questions. And if you don't, you'll be taken to a federal district judge who will say, you have use immunity, you have no Fifth Amendment privilege, you must testify, are you going to answer the question? And when you say no, there won't be a trial. There won't be any determinant sentencing. You're going to wear an orange jumpsuit until you either say you're going to testify or maybe 3 years down the pike, they're finally convinced you won't testify at all. They're coming after you, and you should be scared because the people around you are giving information. How do you think we found out about the Ellis memo? They're turning on you. And Donald Trump will turn on you and say, I never told him to do that. It's sort of like Henry II asking, will no one rid me of this troublesome priest? Speaking of Thomas Becket. And that's how he talks, though. Someone will rid him of you. Or in your case, you tried to rid him of Joe Biden. You're done. And the person that you really are will be seen. And your name, not even before Donald Trump's, your name will stand right next to Benedict Arnold. But you can't run to England and become a general. You're the worst of the worst. The worst of the worst because you're smart. Donald Trump is stupid. You're smart. So don't be looking for any help from anybody. And when you're exposed, you're going to help destroy Donald Trump and the Trump side of the party. I really believe that.
That almost sounded like a eulogy.
It was a eulogy.
Yeah.
It's his political eulogy.
Yes.
It's his political eulogy. That's all there is to it.
Very powerful.
So that's what I really think.
Yeah, that's I don't get these people. Jeff and I were talking earlier about Steve Bannon. And of course the backdrop for all of this is we're talking about their refusal to cooperate and to honor the subpoenas that were legally, lawfully issued by a select committee of Congress. Because they've just decided that they're above it. And of course they've been well conditioned to expect that they're above it. That's the whole shtick of the Trump operation is they are the law. They're not subject to the law. There is nothing over them. We were also talking earlier, this just got me thinking about that. You know, when Trumpsters talk about treason and being a traitor, they're never talking about rising up against the United States or betraying the United States. To a Trump acolyte, being a traitor means betraying Donald Trump. Donald Trump, as far as they're concerned, is the United States. He is the sovereign. Why anybody? Let's think about this.
Really?
I'm gonna pick a person, right, who I think should be king for life and monarch over all. How do you land on a D-list reality show circus clown? I don't know how. I don't know what this guy has going for him.
Yeah. Because Bozo died.
What's the, right.
Bozo died, so they went to the next guy down the room. Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, they emptied out the clown car, and here we are.
They found a body,
so
what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This guy, they didn't pick a philosopher. They didn't pick a general. They didn't pick an intellectual. They didn't pick somebody, who appears in any way to achieve excellence. But here we are. And that brings me to Steve Bannon. As you mentioned when we were talking earlier, Jeff, he, when asked what he is, said he's not a communist, but he's a Leninist. And of course he can't, of course most of the people in Trump's orbit or most of his followers don't know what communist means, right? I'm sorry to
But he's not a communist. He's a Leninist. He says, I'm not a communist. Yeah. I'm a
right.
Leninist.
Yes, not
okay?
a communist.
Which is
right.
different. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we'll circle back to that in a minute, what he means by that. But I can't help but throw in here. I saw a bit.
That was me. Sorry about that.
Okay.
Shame
on you.
Go ahead. Yeah, shame on me.
But there's a guy named Walter Masterson who I follow on Twitter. He's one of these people who goes to Trump rallies or, at gatherings where people are supporting Trump and interviews people.
In other words, he has no life?
Well,
in other words, he has no life?
Yeah. Let me be clear. He does that to expose them for the intellectual
misfits. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought he was a
right, that they are.
Go ahead. Right.
No. So he pretends to be, though. He dresses up in Trump gear and whatever, goes to these rallies and talks to people. And he interviewed a couple of Trump supporters and said, these Democrat communists, we got to get rid of these communists. And, of course, they start getting all worked up, right? Yeah, we got to get rid of these communists. He says, what we need to do to get rid of these communists, first thing we got to do is go after the big corporations and the banks and get them all closed down. And we got to get workers united together and take control of the means of production at the state level. That's what we need to do. And they're sitting there saying, yes, 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 this is what we need to do, not realizing that he's describing communism. So these anti-communists can easily be talked into communism if it's in the name of Trump. So Bannon says, he's not for, state control of the means of production and all this. He's a Leninist, which means essentially what? Just tear it all down, right?
Correct. Out of chaos comes order.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what kind of
order? Out of chaos comes order.
Yeah.
Right. Autocratic
by order, of course, he means order. Yeah, just exactly what I was going to say. Autocracy is the order he's talking about.
Right.
Right.
And this is what I don't get. I don't get how you can look at the founders, the political philosophy that went into, the careful thought that went into the structure of the Constitution, the evolution of the United States, the shining city. I don't want to be too romanticize it too much, but the shining city on the hill, as Ronald Reagan used to put it, the country that the world looks up to, the American experiment, and just decide I'm going to tear that all down. It's like it's the destructive impulse that I see in these big game hunters who kill just to kill, a magnificent beast. And you'll tear it down just to tear it down, just to show that you can. That's the kind of monsters we're talking about here. So Steve Bannon, he got what he wanted, it looks like. I mean, I'm all for the referral, the criminal referral, and the Department of Justice. Last week I was saying the Department of Justice was going way too slow. I'm glad they finally got around to getting an indictment. But of course, he took this opportunity to showboat and to pull his Leninist act, threatening to bring down the quote unquote Biden regime, proving once again he's an anti-constitutionalist, the scary part is, I'll just end with this thought. The scary part is, how many people in the United States will see him as a hero and a martyr? That's the dangerous part of all this. Go ahead, Jeff.
It is. It's very dangerous. You have to remember that Hitler had his Goebbels. Okay? And Bannon is Hitler's Goebbels.
Mm-hmm.
He's the guy that goes out and speaks all the revolutionary rhetoric, while Trump tries to make it sound like he's not a revolutionary, an anti-revolutionary, because I honestly believe the American Revolution has never ended. That the Constitution was just another step in that revolution. And that as the document says, strive to make a more perfect union, it continues the thought process and the revolution that was started by our founding fathers. Maybe in areas that they never conceived it would go. But who conceives where a revolution is going to actually, you know, mutate into? And he really wants to just blow it all up. And then the funny part is everybody says, well, he can't be Lenin. Lenin was a communist. Well, Lenin used communism as a mechanism. It was a populist thought. It really wasn't supposed to be the government. It was just a populist thought. The proletariat shall rise because you'll be in power, which is not different than what Trump's saying. You guys are in charge now. All you gun-toting, tobacco-chewing, cowboy boot-wearing ignoramuses who won't pay for an education for your kids or your grandchildren because you don't want them to be smarter than you, that they should be happy if they have a job that pays $10 an hour, drive a pickup truck, have your shotgun, okay, and you know, go out and shoot stuff. And what, you know, what else do you need in life, right? And that's
dream.
The way that was good enough for my life. It's good enough for you. And besides, I don't want you looking at me like I'm stupid. I know I'm stupid. So I'm just going to keep you stupid. But that's what Bannon thrives on. That's what Trump thrives on, is the ignorance, the absolute and total ignorance of the people that idolize him. And Bannon just is one of those guys, and they don't understand that Lenin used communism as a mechanism to become an authoritarian. And the only reason why Lenin died when he did is because Stalin wanted to replace him and be the boss, and Lenin was going to abandon communism. He was going to announce it doesn't work, let's try something else. And that's why Stalin had, if Stalin didn't do it himself, had Lenin killed. Lenin died of poison, no question about it.
I never realized that.
Yeah.
I've got to go.
Stalin had him
book.
Poisoned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are letters that he has written where he said communism is a failure. It won't work. It works in a commune. It doesn't work for a country.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, and there weren't supposed to be countries under utopian communism. We were just all separate little communes doing certain things, living on our own, taking care of ourselves, okay, in small groups, relatively small groups, not countries.
Kibbutz.
Communism doesn't work for countries. Okay, it just doesn't. I mean, you need a bureaucracy to run a country. And a bureaucracy is the exact opposite of a communist, true utopian communism. So it was a pipe dream. And so he wrote that he wanted to do away with it. He spoke that he wanted to do away with it with people that were in his inner circle. And Stalin wanted to be the boss, and he had the power. Even though he wasn't Russian, he's Georgian. He spoke no Russian. People didn't realize that about Stalin either. He did not speak Russian. So
if you tried to explain this to a Trump voter that he was Georgian and he didn't speak Russian, they would say, of course not. He has a Southern accent.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. I thought they were going to say he's in Atlanta.
Right.
Yeah, he's one of us. No. He doesn't. He lives in Brunswick, and he chases guys down and shoots them. We're going to talk about that in a little while, too.
Oh, God.
Okay. We're going to talk about that one in a while. I think the first thing we should do is, if this upsets people, the things we say, we should bring on a black preacher so that, you know, they can complain about that too. By the way, Jesse Jackson sounded so old. when they were talking to him. Of course, he is. But it was interesting, how, you know, how old he sounded. But, you know, that's just – and that's Bannon. He just wants to tear it all down, create an autocracy with an upper class that he intends on being in. You know, this is a guy who's paying for everything in his life off of the backs of people who gave him contributions regarding, you know, a wall. So, you know, this is a very bad man, a really, really bad man. And, of course, if you're surrounding Donald Trump, the chances are you are a bad man. So that's kind of the deal. And I agree with you. It's just, you know, he's just a bad guy. We had so many other subjects to talk about. I wanted to throw one thing in before we move on. Liz Cheney. Yesterday or last night, or over the weekend, I'm sorry, the Wyoming Republican Party threw her out of the party. Said she no longer belongs to the Wyoming Republican Party, and that she has to return all the contributions she got from them in 2020 and any other organizations, Republican organizations that gave her money in 2020, they're entitled to their money back. That ain't going to happen. Okay. I mean, that's nice for you to say, but it ain't going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you give a contribution, you give a contribution. If somebody doesn't do what you want them to do, you don't ask for your money back.
Right.
Okay? There's no such thing as switch and bait, a bait and switch in politics. But it was 31 to 29. And
wow.
The amazing part is that there were 29 people who said no. And that is a crack. That's a crack in the party. That will divide the party. And those 29 people will be out there working for Liz Cheney. Now, it also sets what is not discussed in all the articles, is her being removed from the Republican Party in Wyoming is absolutely the excuse that McCarthy needs to throw her out of the Republican caucus. And I anticipate in the fairly near future that's what he's going to try to do. She has survived two votes already to remove her. I don't know whether the third time's a charm. Or McCarthy may try to do it as a fiat, throw her out of the caucus because she's not a Republican. Republicans in Wyoming have said so. And if she is forced, which I don't think they can force her to, but if they force her to run as an independent, she's going to win.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to vote for a Democrat, and I think the massive number of Wyoming Republicans are going to vote for her. So I don't agree with her on 90%. She voted 90% with Trump, 90%. Mm-hmm. But that was not enough. Her Republican
right.
bona fides are not enough. So... and her conservative bona fides are not enough. So with all of that said, good-o, Liz Cheney. You just keep fighting the battle. And, you know, I support you because you are a constitutionalist. We may not agree with what the policy should be, but we agree that they should be based on the Constitution, not a cult. So good-o on you. Let's see. We need to talk about the infrastructure bill in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
We need to talk about the constitutional challenges that are going to come its way,
right.
which is counterproductive, especially for Republicans who are going to go home and claim, look what I brought you. You voted
yeah.
against it, you jerk. I'm waiting for Jordan to go back and say, look at all the money I'm bringing you.
Mm-hmm.
And have somebody stand up and say, what do you mean you brought us? You voted against the bill. We would end up with nothing if it was up to you. You can't take credit for this money. But the real problem is that there will be a tax that will come the way that the new bill did. And this really falls into Brandon's wheelhouse in regards to those bills that were passed during work projects that were passed during Roosevelt and the new and his New Deal, and
right.
how the court ruled, because he had a conservative court that he had to deal with. So why don't you explain this all out?
Yeah, I mean, the people who are saying that this the new legislation, the infrastructure bill, is unconstitutional, what they're saying is it's beyond the scope of Congress's authority. Congress doesn't have the authority to do this. And it always comes back to people arguing that the states, you know, are the ones that have the general police power to regulate for the health, safety, and general welfare of the population, and Congress should be sticking to, you know, very narrow tasks like, you know, building post offices and, you know, renaming post offices and coining money and, you know, all this quaint old stuff. There was a time, well, to set the backdrop for this, Congress gets its power, what we call enumerated powers, from a list in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which says Congress may do the following things. And there's actually a numbered list of things Congress is allowed to do. And they're limited to that list. They're not allowed to do anything that is not enumerated. With regard to power that is listed, Congress's power is pretty much absolute and not to be questioned. The key power that Congress has, the one that they invoke the vast majority of time, the time when they legislate, is the power in Article 1, Section 8 to regulate commerce among the states. The Constitution was drafted largely because before the Constitution, we were, of course, operating under the Articles of Confederation, which was something akin to the European Union, right? Just kind of a loose affiliation of separate states. We had states had their own navies. States were entering into their own treaties with foreign countries. States were coining their own money. And most problematic to the framers, states were also engaging in trade wars among themselves.
I don't want to interrupt here, but I think that people need to understand that the original colonies, when we broke away, believed that they were independent countries.
Right.
They had their own constitution. Mm-hmm. They did everything on their own, and they weren't really one country. They weren't states
right.
as we know them. States were descriptions for countries.
Right.
City-states mm-hmm. and things like that. And so these 13 colonies all the way through the Confederation believed that they were separate countries, and they were
right.
just getting together to do common stuff that they knew that they had to do. So I think
right.
people need to understand why we're called states.
Yeah, that's right. And the founders who gathered in Philadelphia, you know, if we could put this in colloquial terms, would say, you know, this is no way to run a country. It's not. You know, it's more of an alliance.
But
right?
we're
not,
not
a
country. Okay.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah. Well, they decided they wanted one, right? So here we are. Yeah,
exactly.
That's
when we became a country.
And that's why the framers of the Constitution gave Congress, at the federal level, gave Congress the authority to regulate commerce among the states. You know, incidentally, the Constitution also says states don't get to have their own armies and navies, right? They don't get to have their own coin their own money. They don't get to enter into treaties with foreign countries. So that in our system, all of that is reserved to the federal government, and so is interstate commerce. Now, there was a time when the Supreme Court had a very narrow view of what interstate commerce means. And the court was striking down New Deal era laws passed by Congress on the basis that Congress didn't have the power to do this. For example, Congress, as part of its legislation in that era, banned the use of child labor in manufacturing. And the Supreme Court struck down Congress's law, saying, well, child labor is a local activity that does not directly impact interstate commerce, and so Congress does not have the authority. To the extent that can be regulated at all, it would have to be regulated at the state level. So that's the kind of argument you're going to hear from opponents of the new infrastructure bill. Here's the problem for them. Even under the most restrictive view of what interstate commerce means. And I hate to get too in the weeds here, but basically the Supreme Court, a very conservative Supreme Court under Rehnquist, right, William Rehnquist, ruled that commerce means the following things: channels of commerce, instrumentalities of commerce, and any activity, even if it's local, that substantially affects interstate commerce. Congress can regulate any one of those categories. Even Justice Thomas, who by far has the most restrictive view of what interstate commerce means and how much power it gives Congress, even he agrees that at the very least, the Commerce Clause means that Congress gets to regulate channels and instrumentalities. Now, what are those? A channel of commerce, you can think about, the examples are the best way to understand it. A channel of commerce is a highway, a railway, a navigable waterway, air corridors. Those are all channels of commerce, so that makes sense. That's the stuff through which commerce flows. Instrumentalities of commerce are the things that use the channels, you know, locomotives, trucks, aircraft, vessels. I'm going to repeat this, even Justice Thomas agrees that those things are regulable by Congress under the Commerce Clause. Well, what is the infrastructure bill? What's it about? It's about bridges, roads, right? Waterways, broadband, and all this, right? At all of these channels and instrumentalities of commerce, right, to accommodate and promote smoother interstate commerce. So the argument that this law is unconstitutional, you know, I would say borders on the absurd, but it's not just bordering on the absurd. It is flatly absurd. Even Clarence Thomas is going to rule that Congress has the authority to do this.
Problem. Yeah, I mean, I take a look at, for example, first of all, the proper name is the Interstate Defense Highway System, so that everybody knows that one of the justifications for the federal government creating this highway system, and it was done very cleverly, was to make it a defense issue, to prepare this country for a conventional war,
right?
Creating the highways and what we now know as the outer belts around major centers, to make the population centers, to make them defensible. And so they did that. Then they also said, look, we're partnering with the states. The states would get 90% of the money to build these roads. But because they participated, they would use the state would then be given the money to build the roads, to build the highways that are being built and are going to be built. And they would then use state eminent domain.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause the question was, did the federal government really have an eminent domain claim against private property? That still appears to be being argued to this very day, especially along our southern border. And so as a result of which, they now had state action, so the state couldn't complain that the federal government was exceeding their authority. They were very, very clever in the way that they built our interstate highway system, and we've become so dependent upon it that the states would no more avoid it. They're begging for the money.
Of course, right.
To help their own highway system. Now, what's great is that fits into another ridiculous thought process. The junior senator from the state of Texas, they call him Ted, but that's not really his first name. Ted Cruz has been backing now for a couple of weeks the idea that the state of Texas should secede if they pass a voter rights law, that the state of Texas should secede from the union. Okay, I want you to understand the stupidity of all of this. Okay, first of all, those highways that we built, that they would have to fence the full length of all of them, so no one could come into the Republic of Texas and just drive in, and you're there. And yeah, I agree, but that's not the point. It's the shortest distance between two points. If you're in New Orleans, you do not want to go north and around Texas. You want to go through Texas to get to New Mexico or the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
So he wants to do that. Now, he doesn't understand that Dallas could no longer be a hub for American Airlines because you would have to fly into a foreign country to make your connections. So American Airlines is going to leave DFW, and they're going to lose, and all the airlines are going to leave Houston Hobby and Houston International, Bush, okay? And all of those medical device and medical biomedical industries that have centered themselves in Houston would have to leave because they're not going to get any government money. Okay, why would the United States give money to the economy of the Republic of Texas? So they'll all leave. That means you'd have this brain drain. All the tech would leave. All of that would leave. But he'd be able to put anybody he wanted on the southern border, I guess, since it's their border. I mean, it's absurd. And as far as I'm concerned, I've said this before on this show. If they want to secede, as we say in Yiddish, Sei gesund, go with God. Okay?
Yeah.
Yep.
Go with God. Okay? I really wish you all the best. And I wish you'd take that 60 or 70 million Trump voters with you. Maybe you can make Trump the king of Texas. Okay? I don't really care what you do down there. Y'all will starve. You haven't got enough really good farmland to feed yourselves.
No.
And the oil industry will leave you because they don't want to lose the United States that having their oil taxed by Texas, because that's the only income they would have. I don't know what y'all are going to live on. I don't know what kind of jobs you're going to have, but you'll be wearing your sidearms on a holster walking down the street. Maybe you could have gunfights. Then the herd. I really don't understand that thought process. But, I mean, this guy is so desperate to out-Trump Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And I want you to remember his father was a refugee from Cuba who believes in the United States of America.
Yeah.
It made him what he was. Teddy. So, I just had to throw that one in. I did go with what you were saying.
No, that's good.
The highways. Yeah.
Well, just to your point, it reminds me this talk of secession, right, threatening to secede. When I was a little kid, I decided I was going to threaten my mother with running away from home, right, because I was, a petulant little fill-in-the-blank.
How far did you get?
Yeah. Well, you see where I'm going with this.
I want to know how far you got before you ate all the cookies, but go ahead.
I read the Three Little Pigs. And I thought I could just go build a brick house, right, somewhere, and then I'd be fine, right? So I pack my bags, and I go tell my mother, I'm out of here. I'm going to go run away. And she said, okay, see you later.
I want to know what you packed. What did you pack?
I can't remember what I packed. No, I just remember packing my favorite stuff. And but that's the attitude of the United States. Yeah, well, of course. but that's what we the next southern state that threatens to secede, that's the way we ought to handle it. Okay, go ahead.
Hey, nobody said we wanted you back in the first place. Okay, okay, we let you come back only because we felt sorry for you. Okay, okay, I mean, that's the only reason why we let you come back. As far as we're concerned, go seriously.
Yeah. It literally would be the world's newest third world country.
Without any question, within a year, everybody would be gone. Yeah. Every bit of commerce would be gone. Okay? Don't need your cows. They put out too much methane anyway. I mean, don't need you. Don't want you. Houston would be a ghost town. Dallas would be a ghost town. There would be nobody living there that's living there now, which means obviously the 70 million can get really cheap housing. I think that's great. You know, and I don't know who's going to take care of your roads as the pickup trucks rip them apart. Mm-hmm. And when they want to go visit their families, they're going to need a passport. And they're going to have to go through customs and immigration, okay? And they can only come in on a visa.
Yeah,
I mean, I really think that's fabulous.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He didn't really think this through. I mean, you know, wait a minute, maybe I really should have thought about the end game here. It sounded good, but the end game doesn't sound so great. So I just thought I'd throw that one out there in light of your conversation about interstate commerce. They'd no longer be a state. We could put tariffs on everything coming out of there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Put tariffs on their oil. That's all they really have.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think the oil companies would stay because they own too much stuff around the rest of the country. Foreign ownership of our oil reserves. No. Sorry, guys. We're taking that away from you. We're nationalizing it. We can't have a foreign country owning our oil reserves. Are you kidding? Oh, that's dangerous to national security. Okay. And when the Mexicans come to your border and charge across, ain't going to be our army that's going to stop them. Okay? Somehow or another, I think Dallas would become the new Alamo. I don't know, okay? You know, where's Maximilian when we need him? That kind of thing. I mean, they just don't get it. They literally don't get it. But that's okay. Hopefully Texans, as more Democrats move into Texas, they'll realize it's got to go.
Speaking of the infrastructure bill, how about Rob Portman?
Thank you for reminding me of that.
Yeah.
Good O to you, Rob Portman. I know you're not running for reelection. I got it. But you stood up there and could not have said Biden couldn't say better what that bill was about than you did. Your speech, it made me proud to be a Buckeye. I'm telling you that he was fabulous yesterday at the signing ceremony. A featured speaker, a Republican senator. Only one of three of the 19 who voted for the bill. Even the ones who voted for the bill were scared to show up. But it was fabulous. And I was really proud of him. And he belongs in the United States Senate. And it's a loss that he's leaving, despite the fact that he's a conservative guy. It's still a loss, a terrible loss. And I think just a good O out to him.
Yeah. And Rob, you go back to people screaming and yelling about the infrastructure bill, how you have to be a communist. Marjorie Taylor Greene and her ilk, this is communist legislation. Yeah, right. Rob Portman, a well-known communist, right?
Yeah, really. Rob Portman is a communist. Yeah, he's a Manchurian candidate. There's no question about it.
Yeah, right, right.
I would say this, that Marjorie Taylor Greene can have some real problems when the county administrators in the counties in which she is or within her district, start asking for that money. And when Brian Kemp, I want to hear Brian Kemp say that this is communist and it's a bad bill. Fine, we won't send any of that money to the state of Georgia. You explain to everybody in Georgia Why everybody else is building roads and you're not. Why everybody else is building bridges and you're not. I want you to explain that to them. And Marjorie Taylor Greene, I want you to explain it to the 250,000 people in your district. But she'll go home and say, look at the money we're bringing you. And the response has to be, what's this wee shit? You got a mouse in your pocket? You didn't do anything. You voted against the bill. You called it communist. You think it's a terrible thing. And if it was up to you, we'd be getting nothing. And that's going to happen to a lot of Republicans who are going to go home and start claiming, you know, like someone like, what's his name from Ohio, Jordan, the Shonda, okay, who will go home and say, I'm bringing money for this bridge and that bridge. Someone's eventually going to stand up and say, what are you talking about? You didn't do anything. We're getting that money despite you, not because of you.
Hmm.
That's their problem when they're running. They'll try to take credit for this. I mean, we already saw Mitch McConnell do it with the COVID funds that he voted against, that no Republican voted for, and went home and said, we brought into Texas this amount of money.
Right.
You had nothing to do with it. Bashir was the reason why Kentuckians got money. Not you. And they need to be called out on it, and hopefully, you know, their newspapers will do just that. Stop taking credit for something you didn't do. So, yeah. Rob Portman, yay you. Yay you. And I'm sorry to see you go. I really am. And Patrick Leahy, I'm sorry to see him go now, too. Although that seat is pretty safe Democratic seat. But I'm sorry to see him go. I mean, with 40 years in the United States Senate.
Yeah.
That's
right.
Friggin' amazing. That's friggin' amazing. I'm sorry. Let's see. We got a few minutes.
Well, you used to be a judge, so I think you need to talk about the judge in the Rittenhouse case. That's what everybody's talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. Oh, yeah.
I teed that one up for you. I'm just going to be quiet. And
boy, did you tee that one up. I have been dying as a talking head to go national, and I want to thank the judge in the Rittenhouse case for allowing me to do that. Okay, yesterday I was quoted extensively on NPR radio. And I got a phone call from my daughter in Denver, said I was driving somewhere and I'm listening to NPR and there's my father's voice, okay, which shocked the hell out of her. And a few other people, you know, a large number of people that I know listened to NPR. I was really surprised. I didn't think they were NPR kind of people.
Very big.
This guy is, yeah, it is really big. I did not really realize how big they were. This judge is just, to me, the epitome of what judges aren't supposed to be. He is arrogant. He is prideful. He is overbearing. He is intemperate. He's not particularly bright. He clearly has shown his bias and prejudice towards the defendant. He has attempted to handcuff the state at every single turn with some of the stupidest things I've ever heard. I mean, who doesn't understand that they can expand a photo on their phone and, you know, and blow it up so you can see things better? And he says, yeah, but when those pixels are gone, what replaces them? Who cares? What does that have to do with admitting a picture that has been blown up by a process that's scientifically recognized by courts all over the country? I mean, this is not an issue that the state has to go out and get an expert to come in and explain it to him. The people on the jury understood. They own a cell phone. Yelling and screaming. First of all, debating the law with the prosecutor in front of the jury, you don't do that. That's putting your thumb on the scales. And you don't yell and scream at a lawyer in court where you're only separated by a thin wooden door from a jury who's supposedly been removed from the room. And you're yelling into a microphone. Mm. Like the jury isn't hearing this. The ruling that the people who got shot aren't victims. They're victims of a shooting. Nobody says the defendant did it, but they are the victims of a shooting. They died from gunshot wounds that somebody else shot a bullet and put in them. That makes them a victim. And just because they're the victim of a shooting doesn't take away from a justification defense such as self-defense. The truth is, if it's self-defense, you have to admit that you purposely fired those shots. I was really disappointed in the prosecutor on that point. He had to say, when you assert affirmative defense of self-defense, you are admitting that you shot to kill. And you want to be excused from it. And I just don't understand this ruling that people who are being called looters and rioters with absolutely no evidence that they were participating in a riot or looting. They can't get up there and say that's not true, can they?
Right.
So you're shaming and blaming the victims? If they did something to be blamed for, that's fine. Kyle Rittenhouse put four shots into a guy. The fourth one was, by the way, the fatal bullet. The other three were not life-threatening. He shoots a guy who's unarmed. And then feels like, I'm the victim of being attacked by other people. You're goddamn right you were. Those people had the right to attack you to protect themselves from you. The only people who died out there were the people that Rittenhouse killed. He did things that the police weren't allowed to do. And you sit there and put handcuffs on a prosecutor? The hell is wrong with you? He is literally an embarrassment to people who do and have served on the bench. He's horrible. And he clearly is biased and prejudiced. And I'm saying it out loud. Some of the clips that I gave never made it to the air. But you're biased and you're prejudiced and you're an embarrassment and you should be removed from the bench. Now file a bar complaint against me in Florida. And I'll bring in two federal judges who are on television saying the same thing that I did. Okay, you're going to sue them too? You're going to go after their license? You aren't going to win, but come on down. So I can say in a hearing exactly what I said and exactly how I feel and back it up with facts. And the last thing is that he made a ruling and argued with the prosecutor over this that they could not comment on Rittenhouse's out-of-court statements, his pre and post-indictment statements. Excuse me. He's given interviews to the press. He never asserted his right to remain silent to a police officer. And when he was finally arraigned, he asserted his right to counsel. That's all. You know what? Salinas versus Texas, pal. Thompson versus Burgess versus Thompson. Clearly, your statements to others and your failure to talk to the police can be commented on. You never looked at a police officer and said, I'm asserting my right to remain silent. You just never said anything. You never talked to them. But in the meantime, why are you telling the press all these things, but you're not telling the police? Is a legitimate question.
Mm-hmm.
And that ruling was wrong, 100% wrong on the law. They coined a phrase of a former professor I worked with who I didn't like very much. You're wrong on the law. The prosecutor was right. That's just crap. So, you know, if it comes back with any kind of conviction, I anticipate he will not put Rittenhouse in jail unless he is bound to. If it comes back as purposeful murder, he has to sentence him to prison. But if he can get around putting Rittenhouse in prison by saying he was a juvenile at the time, and I feel bad for this young man, he made a mistake, he shouldn't pay for his whole life with it, he will do that. But I was watching the closings yesterday, and CNN was terrific. They had side-by-side live. One was Vickers. I think his name is Vickers, if I'm not, or Vickery, who was the prosecutor. And the other one was on Rittenhouse. And that kid was scared. Because everything that that prosecutor was saying was exactly the way it happened, exactly what he did, exactly what he said, and he knew it. His lies were being exposed. And for all of you who said the prosecutor did a terrible cross-examination of Rittenhouse, you were wrong. It was, at the time I said, it was a great cross-examination. He set Rittenhouse up. He got what he wanted out of him. He bound him to a story, even if he thought it was helping him to say those things. And that prosecutor did one of the best closing arguments I have ever heard, laced with video to back up what he was saying. If I were Rittenhouse, I'd have been scared too. He nailed it. And the defense attorney did a horrible closing because he did not know how to answer such a cogent and well-prepared and chronological closing argument. He isn't going to get a conviction of it. It's going to be a hung jury. But that judge interrupted him a couple of times and stopped him and criticized him during his closing argument. I thought it was horrible, just a terrible display of what judges do to swing cases the way they want them to go. But I can't tell you how I really feel.
So we got what you really think. We got that twice at least.
Yeah, you got twice in 1 week. Yeah.
Right.
Oh, it was really horrible. I was watching that, and I just by the way, the prosecutor who did the rebuttal argument was terrible. But it didn't detract from the opening. The defense, you know, the prosecution gets two closings. They get the first closing, and then they do the rebuttal. And I thought the guy that did the rebuttal was not very good.
Yeah,
he was too busy checking things off on his list, and it wasn't cogent, and it didn't, because he was trying to respond to the defense attorney as he wrote it down, and the defense attorney was all over the place. All he wanted to do was create confusion. So he jumped from this subject to that subject, over here, over there. Nothing was cogent about what he said, and he bought into that in the way that he answered everything. So I thought that was bad. I think they should have taken a 10-15, at least a half an hour break, and he should have put things in a chronological order the way he wanted to answer it.
Yeah.
So I didn't think he was very good, but Vickers or Vickery, whatever his name is, was outstanding. That was an hour and 45 minutes, just outstanding. It was great. I would show that closing as to teach students how to do a closing argument.
Mm-hmm.
I really would. And he should be proud of himself. He tried a great case as much as people were criticizing him during the trial. He did a great job. He really did. With one hand tied behind his back.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I feel. That's what I think about the Rittenhouse trial.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to find out shortly. I'm betting on the hung jury.
Yeah.
I'm betting on that. So Yeah. Well, we've gone over by 7 or 8 minutes.
Yep.
Okay.
So, you got anything you want to add?
You're only
anything
infringing
else you got on your mind,
only
Brendan?
Infringing on my time.
Yeah, well, we've
but
been
that's
doing
okay.
that now for a year and a half, so.
Yeah, right.
That's okay. What were you going to say, Brendan?
No, I think that's a good place to end off with an exclamation point. So.
Okay. Well, okay.
Onward
I guess we're done for today. Hezzy, thank you again for your time. I appreciate
Thanks, Hezzy.
You've been
a great
friend. I appreciate that.
It was an exemplary dissertation. I learned a great deal today. Thank you very much. I feel a little smarter than I was before.
That's because we're not very good teachers, because if we were good teachers, you'd be a lot smarter. So the fact that you're only a little
smarter. I feel
smarter
I'm getting there.
Doesn't speak well of us. Okay. That's why they call me Professor Dark Cloud. Just remember, inside every silver lining, there's a dark cloud. So. Okay, have a great weekend.
All the best.
We'll talk to you really soon. Brendan,
all the best to both of you.
Take care of yourself, buddy. Okay.
All
and
right.
Don't strain any muscles while you're moving, okay?
I'll try.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, take care. Have a great day, everybody.
Yep.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you both. Bye.
Bye.
Oh, how wonderful. Well, we're going to move on to the next segment. We'll be doing some first local stuff, and then we'll continue with some international. I wanted to read this to you because we're going to have a discussion about this tomorrow. And this is also has to do with the Constitution. This is written by socioeconomic research scholar Orrin M. Levin-Waldman. It's already online on the Yonkers Tribune website. And the title of this article is called By Design, the American Party System Follows the Broker Model. Well, unlike European countries, the United States has never had a responsible party model. Instead, it has had what is known as a broker party model. The tension between progressive Democrats and moderate Democrats in Congress, to a certain extent, mirrors the tension between the two models. A responsible party model is usually ideological, where the goal is to win programs. In a broker model, the goal is to win elections, and the promise of programs and or other policies is only a means to attaining that end. A broker party model is non-ideological. Candidates are selected by the voters, usually through primary elections and or participatory caucuses. The goal is to win elections, and contributions are generally made to candidates. In the United States, where we have mainly a two-party system, each party stakes out a position that will get itself elected. Now, once elected, the goal, of course, is re-election. Again, programs and policies are only secondary to the first goal, which is winning elections. Now, the U.S. has a broker party model precisely because it has a two-party system, and the main reason we have a two-party system is because we have single-member districts. It was French political scientist Maurice Duverger who theorized in what has come to be known as Duverger's law that single ballot pluralities and single member districts tended to favor two-party systems. In short, because only one person can represent a district and that person's election is based on winner take all, only the two strongest parties will survive. In parliamentary systems, which characterizes most European nations, districts are multi-party districts whereby more than one person can represent a district, and election is based on proportional representation. Now, this allows for parties to be more ideological. Indeed, in a responsible party model, the goal is to win programs. the parties choose their candidates and donations are made to the party. Whereas a broker party model has loose party control, a responsible party has very tight control. In a responsible party model, when rank and file members in parliament break ranks with the party leadership, the government usually falls and new elections are called. Because the U.S., with its separation of powers and single-member districts, allows governing administrations, even failed administrations, to remain in office until the next scheduled election, the government never falls. The result, of course, is ungovernability, with the public being held hostage until the next election. As we mentioned previously in this space, this was no accident. Rather, the framers of the Constitution deliberately designed a political system that would not be able to act so as to protect individual rights, albeit by default. Now, the framers chose Republican government because they feared that democracy would lead to mob rule following their irrational passions. Only those who had the time and wisdom to devote to the public interest would be able to employ reason. But they also viewed party government as no less evil than interest groups, and both parties and interest groups were likened to factions. To the framers, interest groups as factions would put their interest above the public good, and they had no reason to believe that political parties would behave any differently. Of course, the modern political party may retort that it does indeed speak for the public interest. Moreover, how can a system that is so robust because it is so difficult to act, because it is difficult to achieve consensus, ever really give expression to the public interest? And yet this question underscores the problem with defining the public interest and the very reason the framers would only want a system that could govern through incremental steps. After all, how do we know? Who is to say that Group A's conception of the public interest is better than Group B's? And this very question gets to the very heart of the meaning of liberalism, especially as it revolves around neutrality. As political philosopher, liberalism rejects absolutes and embraces tolerance for diversity. At the heart of liberalism is the idea of human agency. Each person has the capacity to identify a conception of the good for him or herself and chart out a plan to bring that good to fruition. Well, the role of the state, then, is to be a neutral with regards to conceptions of the good, because to make a choice is to effectively say one's conception is better than the other. This is a fundamental dilemma that policy poses to liberalism, because if a policy course has been chosen, then the state is not neutral. Arguably, the concept of neutrality is given choice in the idea of limited government, and a government that governs through incrementalism comes close. On the other hand, a government that is neutral can't act, even when a crisis demands that it does. The only way out of this would be a democratic process whereby not only are all permitted to participate, but all must participate. And those who demand party loyalty to the party position, whatever the issue, be willing to ride roughshod over the rights of others. And while progressives in Congress may think they are speaking for the public interest, that public interest is nothing more than their particular conception of the good. Moderate Democrats and, of course, Republicans have a different view of what constitutes the public interest, and yet progressives aren't willing to listen to the position of moderates. A broker party model is effectively designed to allow our representatives to govern within the framework of checks and balances, whereby a conception of the public interest emerges through consensus. But this requires open debate and compromise. The American political system has become so polarized, not only between Democrats and Republicans and between conservatives and liberals, but within the parties themselves. It would appear as though progressives in their zeal to transform the country are attempting to use the idea of a responsible party model to overcome the obstacles of separation of powers. They would not be the first. Thomas Jefferson, too, sought to govern through party government, whereby he expected members of his political party in Congress to be loyal to his positions. What progressives miss here is that there is no such requirement in the United States Constitution, and that is its inimical, and that it is inimical to incrementalism, which is the only thing that can be achieved through the separation of powers. So if the goal is to have a transformation, then a new constitution is required. Otherwise, if progressives really seek to get anything done, then they should begin engaging in the democratic process was designed. Absolutely brilliant thinking process. It needs to be read over and over again in order to comprehend all of it. I hope I read it well, even though I blundered a couple of times. And this is really quite interesting. There's another article I think you'd find very interesting also on the Yonkers Tribune website. And this is an issue about will Islam survive Islamism? This is written by Daniel Pipes. Islamist movement, which seeks to apply medieval Islamic laws and build a worldwide caliphate, has expanded massively in the past half century, but it now faces a significant and growing counter-movement, especially in Muslim-majority countries. Growing numbers of Muslims, spurred by shocks like the fall of Kabul, fear and reject this radical version of Islam. Awareness of the anti-Islamist surge has been largely limited to those directly involved, but it deserves to be much better known. Anti-Islamism comprises four complementary trends, going from quietest to most radical. They are moderate Islam, irreligiosity, apostasy, and conversion to other religions. All have an international presence, but for illustrative purposes, I shall focus in each case on a key Middle Eastern country, moderate Islam in Egypt, irreligiosity in Turkey, atheism in Saudi Arabia, and conversion in Iran. Let's start with moderation. Hosni Mubarak's 30-year police state so consistently accommodated Islamists that Egyptians dared not oppose them. His fall from power in 2011 finally permitted an open expression of views, which the one-year Islamist rule of Mohamed Morsi further galvanized. The results have been hyperbolically anti-Islamist, as seen by street attacks on Muslim Brotherhood appearing men, by women discarding the hijab, and the immense popularity of scathingly anti-Islamist figures such as Islam al-Bihari, Ibrahim Issa, Mukhtar Joma, Khaled Muntazir, and Abdullah Nasser. Even President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, a former Islamist sympathizer, has accommodated these moderate sentiments. Well, Ibrahim Issa is an Egyptian intellectual, just so you know. With regard to irreligiosity, Turkey's Islamist president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has dominated the country's politics in 2002, and with the goal of raising a pious generation, quote unquote. But younger Turks are adopting non-Islamic ways. Survey research by Volkan Erkit found the sacred having less influence regarding such matters as belief in supernatural beings, clothing that reveals body shape, premarital flirtation, non-marital sex, and homosexuality. A government report documented the appeal of deism among religious school students. A 2012 WIN Gallup survey found that, quote, non-religious, end quote, persons make up 73% of Turkey's population, the highest of 57 countries in that were surveyed. Apostasy in Saudi Arabia, flat-out rejection of Islam, quote, is spreading like wildfire, end quote, says a Saudi refugee. The WIN Gallup survey found that, quote, convinced atheists, end quote, make up 5% of the population in Saudi Arabia, the same as the United States. The monarchy has responded in two ways. First, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman partially acquiesced to such sentiments by opening the country to many modern ways. Second, he promulgated anti-terrorist regulations that punish, quote, calling for atheist thought in any form or calling into question the fundamentals of the Islamist religion on which this country is based, end quote. Yes, the monarchy fights atheism with anti-terrorist regulations. Now let's look at conversion. Shai Hatiri, an analyst, writes about Iran that, quote, Islam is the fastest shrinking religion, while Christianity is growing the fastest. Christian Broadcast Network goes further, asserting that, quote, Christianity is growing faster in the Islamic Republic of Iran than in any other country in the world. David Yahsanar of Elam Ministries finds that Iranians have become the most open people to the gospel, end quote. And according to a former Muslim, even an evangelical priest, quote, we find ourselves facing what is more than a conversion to the Christian faith, he said. Quote, it's a mass exodus from Islam, end quote. And Leila Gilbert and Ariel Del Turco report that the mullahs consider Christianity, quote, an existential threat, end quote, to their rule. Reza Safa predicts Iran will become the first Muslim-majority country to convert to Christianity. Confirming those trends, the Iranian intelligence minister, Mahmoud Alavi, publicly expressed fears about Muslims converting to Christianity. Now, some observations about this anti-Islamist surge. It appears limited to Muslim-majority countries among Muslim minorities, especially in the West. Islamism continues to grow. Now, conspiracy theories to the contrary. It results almost entirely from internal development among Muslims, not Muslims. Non-Muslims have but a limited supporting role, as ever Muslims determine their own destiny. Anti-Islamists almost diametrically oppose Islamists on matters of faith, family, social relations, politics, and beyond. Among other implications, free thinkers and ex-Muslims tend to be intensely pro-West, pro-America, and pro-Israel. Expect to see anti-Islamist surges to appear in Nigeria, Bangladesh, and Indonesia. For Islamic trends historically begin in the Middle East and migrate outwards. Thus does Islamism inadvertently drive Muslims away from Islam and potentially shake the very foundation of the faith. Now, one Christian broadcaster even maintains that, quote, the hold of Islam on the Muslim people has crumbled, end quote. radical utopianism has pushed the world's second largest religious community into a concealed but severe crisis with volatile results. This was written by Mr. Pipes. He is the president of the Middle East Forum. And this original publication of this article was first posted by the Washington Post yesterday, and we posted it today. So just brilliant thinking. I think sometimes we push the envelope with what we give expression to on our website, but that's what drives the equation. At least I think so. Now let's just see here. This you might find really interesting as well. Mayor Mike Spano of Yonkers is going to need to appoint someone to replace the Honorable Thomas Quiñones to the Yonkers City Court bench. It seems the Honorable Thomas Quiñones, a Supreme Court Justice-elect to the 9th Judicial District in New York, which covers Westchester, Rockland, Putnam, Dutchess, and Orange counties, is presently serving on the Yonkers City Court of Westchester County in the 9th Judicial District of New York. With Quiñones moving up the ladder, Mayor Mike Spano will need to appoint a replacement to the Yonkers City Court, and those seemingly in contention listed out in alphabetical order are as follows, and this was a breaking news exclusive to the Yonkers Tribune. Well, some of the people being considered are Karen Beltran, she at one time ran for mayor, Alexander Bassesi, I'm not familiar with him, Thomas Daley, who was on the Yonkers City Court bench but lost in the last election to maintain his position. He was the head judge, but he lost. He, however, is over 70 years of age, so even though he is being considered by the administration, he cannot actually be elevated to that post again. Mark Fang, I know him as a lawyer, very well respected out of White Plains, or actually operating in White Plains, but I think he lives in Yonkers. Then you've got Jerry F. Cabrittle II. I don't know anything and never heard his name, but he's definitely on the list. Dusan Lakic, also have not heard of him at all. Brendan McGrath, who also lost in the last election, and yet he was initially the favorite before a sentiment had changed in Yonkers, not specifically against him, but for other candidates who did win. He is being considered again. He was also designated by the mayor to be part of the Municipal Housing Authority in the city of Yonkers, so I'm not sure how that's going to go with regard to him. Sharon Mattee, I don't know her at all. Ada Medina, never heard of her name. Steve Rubio, I don't know his name either. And Nick Speranza. But again, it's not for me to necessarily know. It will be up to the mayor of Yonkers to make a decision on how he wants to move forward. So very, very interesting. Now, with regard to the Yonkers Police Department, the police department in Yonkers, the YPD, have arrested and charged a 15-year-old gang member with attempted murder. Well, detectives from the major case squad and a crime scene unit responded to the scene and interviewed subjects and witnesses, recovered surveillance video, and processed forensic and ballistic evidence. Within hours, investigators were able to trace the victim's movements back to where the shooting incident occurred, in the parking lot of the White Castle restaurant at 257 South Broadway. Investigation yielded that the victim, a 20-year-old resident of Yonkers, had driven to White Castle to meet several individuals in a marijuana transaction. Now, one of the individuals, now a suspect, allegedly displayed a 9mm handgun and attempted to rob the victim of all his property, including his money, drugs, cell phone, and car, and the suspect then fired at least two gunshots at the victim, striking him in the torso. The suspect then fled on foot, and the victim was able to drive himself to the hospital. No other parties reported being injured, and no proceeds were actually taken from the victim. Now, over the next several days, detective follow-up on leads, review surveillance video, and interview the victim and witnesses. Investigators were able to identify the gunman as a 15-year-old male member of the local Makbala Blood Street gang. He was located by major case unit and gang unit detectives on November 9th and placed into custody without incident. The juvenile suspect is known to investigators as he was previously arrested, charged, and convicted of multiple shooting incidents when he was only 13 years old. Well, the juvenile suspect was processed at the Community Affairs Division and charged with attempted murder, too. A Class A1 violent felony in New York State under the New York State Penal Law, and Assault 1, a Class B violent felony in the New York State Penal Law, and he was remanded to a juvenile detention facility pending his next court appearance, and due to his age, he is classified as a juvenile offender and his identity is being withheld from public disclosure. The case is being prosecuted by the Westchester County District Attorney's Office, and additional information may be released as it becomes available. Note, for those listening as well as reading, booking charges are merely accusations and the defendant are presumed innocent unless and until proven guilty in a court of law. The source to this story was Detective Lieutenant Dean Politopoulos. He's the communication director for the Yonkers Police Department Commissioner John Mueller and the Yonkers Police Department. Unbelievable, the sort of stuff that goes on. This is all on our website. Of course, you can read the latest review of the 2021 Mazda CX-30 by Driving Me Crazy duo John and Laurie Wiles, who are at present in England. We didn't do a show with them last Thursday, but you'll be able to hear them this Thursday. I don't know what car they'll be reviewing, so it'll be very, very interesting. This is another, an unknown situation, and it was an exclusive for us as well. Rob Astorino to relaunch his political focus for New York State Comptroller. That was written by me. Well, it seems that political insiders with knowledge have informed the Yonkers Tribune that Rob Astorino, he was at one time the Westchester County Executive. He lost his reelection bid. And so I guess that's about all we need to know about him. He's going to focus his political attention and effort by redirecting his campaign focus for New York State Comptroller against incumbent Thomas DiNapoli. Before that, he was going to run for New York State Governor as a Republican, and he must have realized that conservative support and Republican support of Lee Zeldin has gained support from both political parties, conservatives and Republicans, which have flanked Mr. Astorino. Well, the comments went wild, with regard to, Rob Astorino. People said so. After Westchester spends the past 4 years digging out of the financial messes that Astorino left behind, he now wants to do the same for the state? No, thank you. We don't need your cronyism and fiscal ineptitude plaguing the entire state. Very well expressed and really on point. Spano gives himself a huge raise and the rest of the cronies, a big expose is coming. Some people say stay tuned. Then we have, one second, Okay, then we have, what a nonsensical move. One second here. The present comptroller, Thomas DiNapoli, is very talented and has done a really great job. In 2018, he led the statewide ticket with 65% of the vote. People love him. New York is a Democratic registration state by more than 2-1. So whatever baggage the gubernatorial candidate may bring to the table is not relevant. The notion that Astorino, who lost his last three races for governor, for re-election, for county executive of Westchester, and even for a state Senate seat in his home district, can win a statewide race for comptroller is laughable. Which brings us to the question, why is Astorino considering a race he cannot win? It's a good question. And then another one says, Astorino is washed up. He had his chance. Then another said, Rob, Astorino's days are elected official are over. As an elected official are over. Losing recently to that liberal state senator sealed his fate. He's like Chuck Lesnick. They write it as Chuck Lesnick. But his real last name is Lesnick. Constantly running for office, he should consider his young family and give it a break. Mathematically, he cannot win and realize his 15 minutes of fame have passed forever. So well said about him. He needs to be outed because I see that Lesnick is trying desperately to get back into the political world, but nobody wants to have anything to do with him. Then someone says, Astorino needs to get a real job since no one wants him after, quote, failing, end quote, in three previous runs for governor, county executive, and New York State senator. Both Westchester and New York has rejected his pile of lies and divisive tactics. He could get a truck driving job since the pay is good and the need is there, and by becoming a freight trucker, he won't become a four-time loser. He might even get a job driving one of those new electric trucks from Rivian or from Musk when they appear. Again, very well expressed. You got to love our readers. They are so pithy and they're so on target. And someone says, he has been a good picker of losing battles. Question to Astorino, why would New Yorkers replace a great comptroller with you? You lost a race for county executive, governor, and state senate. You brought shame to the Republican Party. At this point, you are job hunting. Please don't embarrass yourself anymore and get an actual job. Thank you, Hezzy, for the story. Well, thank you for actually making these comments. The last comment is, why don't all these politicos get jobs in the real world? They all wallow in the swamp until another pickings show up. They are everywhere. We need term limits, and also we need those in an office already to step down if they're seeking higher positions. Example, James Nolan and Shelley Mayer, just off the top of my head. You should also not be allowed to fail downwards, either example. As an example, they mention Latimer. Oh, God. Well, you got to love it. These people are pissy. They're on target. They just know what they're talking about. I'm always floored by how exceptional these writers are. Really, really phenomenal. I'm just so thrilled. And, okay, we don't have much time, but I do want to cover about another 21 minutes or so. I want to cover some other things with you, particularly on the international stage. Bear with me a second. Let me just see if I can get this for you. Yeah, this is really quite interesting. The French forces are pulling out of Tessalit base amid the northern Mali drawdown. Well, it seems that France has handed back control of the Tessalit base to the Malian army. military officials announced that was today, part of plans to reorganize French forces deployed in the rest of Sahel region under, quote, Operation Barkhane, end quote. Now, the northern base is the second French outpost to be evacuated after the Kidal base was handed over to the Malian army in October. A third base in Timbuktu will be closed by the end of the year. While air support will be maintained, the 5,100 French troops currently in the Sahel will be reduced to roughly 3,000. European special forces deployed in the task force will be in charge of supporting the Malian military in combat. The idea is not to create a vacuum. The idea is to leave the responsibility of these areas to the Malian state, said General Etienne du Perreux of the French Barkhane force, speaking after the withdrawal from Kidal last month. Quote, and the purpose is to avoid the risk of getting stuck in conflict. We need a response that is not only military, end quote. France, the former colonial power, intervened in Mali in January of 2013 to hold a lightning campaign by jihadists and the Tuareg forces that threatened to overrun the capital of Bamako. But after 8 years of war against jihadist militants, swathes of Mali's territory remain outside the authorities' control. Relations between France and a military junta that took over last year in Mali have soured in recent months, with Mali's transitional authorities accusing the French of abandoning, quote-unquote, the country. Well, the military junta has pointed to Barkhane's drawdown from northern Mali to justify its negotiations with the controversial Russian mercenary group Wagner, a move that has further angered France. And so they're just saying, fine, let them deal with it if that's what they want. These are mercenaries from Russia. Now, let me just look. 1 second here. Where is this? 1 moment here. Now, this is really quite interesting here in South America. Peace reigns in Colombia's former guerrilla fiefdom. Well, it all began in a mountainside hovel perched in the Colombian Andes, where peasant soldiers besieged by government forces founded the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia in 1964. After 50 years of bloody struggle and another five since the 2016 peace accord that ended the FARC's, FARC's battle against the state, this isolated south central region has rediscovered peace. FARC and its war seem a distant memory in Tolima province, 200 kilometers, that's about 125 miles southwest of Bogota, the capital, as where all that remains in the conflict is a few leftover anti-personnel mines and the occasional discreet army patrol. Although the peace deal is holding, the number of armed groups operating in Colombia is on the rise. Yet Tolima is an exception, and here peace reigns. Tolima and the Maquetalia Valley remain synonymous, for Colombians at least, with the war, murder, and the Marxist FARC guerrillas. There were so many awful stories here. It was blood every day, dead bodies with civilians caught in a vice between guerrillas and soldiers, said Leon Noricel Villamil, a local politician for the small town of Planadas and Gaitana. FARC were at home here. They came down from the mountain, went where they wanted. The soldiers built walls, besieged in their barracks. Kidnappings were frequent. In 1964, the army launched an offensive to take control of several peasant shelters set up following the 1948 to 1953 civil war that had come under communist influence. On May 27, battle waged in the Ata-Ata River Canyon in Magatalia Valley, and FARC was born. Magatalia would remain its fiefdom. Right in the center of the country was a strategic place for us, a corridor between the three mountain ranges that connects the north to the south, close to Bogota. Pastor Alape, a former FARC leader, told Agence France-Presse. Even today, it remains an isolated region that is difficult to access. To reach the heart of Magatalia involves a treacherous journey along a dirt track, either by motorcycle or powerful old Russian trucks. Next hour ride on horseback up steep slopes, followed by a trek on foot, knee-high in mud and soaked by rain. The spectacular views makes the ordeal worthwhile. Majestic mountains covered in tropical vegetation, all in the shadow of the snow-capped Nevado del Huila volcano. Cows graze on the hill where FARC was born. Having been briefly occupied by the army, the pasture land is now owned by a farmer. FARC controlled everything with severity, said Alberto Colorado, a peasant who lost five brothers that were forced, quote-unquote, to join the communist rebels before being killed by the army. You had to adapt and obey. Everyone was afraid, he added, sporting a machete in his belt and a parrot on his shoulder. Well, all this is ancient history. Everything changed, said Hector Almario 27, a local community leader. Here there is peace. We move about freely day and night. No one is coming to kill or bombard us anymore. We live in a little paradise, said a smiley Belanit Kumako, 44, another local leader. Well, the entire community meets in the village's only school and old rebel headquarters. Magatalia is made up of 19 families, said Almario, who live off cattle, cheese, and red beans. Gone are the poppy crops, the primary ingredient in heroin that abounded under FARC. There are still disputes, most commonly among over access to a land, but they don't descend into violence in Magatalia. At the end of the working day, D-miners attempting to clear the last unexploded anti-personnel devices left over from the conflict join locals to play football on the school grounds. On the peaks nearby are stationed some discreet soldiers. Sometimes there are rumors about armed groups advancing along the mountain range from the Cauca department to the southwest looking for recruits. We're afraid that the state will leave us to face all these people alone, said Almario. One complaint echoes around the mountains. Our problems are the roads, the trails, the bridges, and the absence of the state, said Kumako. For Villa Mil, the area has, quote, always been abandoned by Bogota, end quote. Since the peace deal was signed, some new paint for the school's walls is, quote, the only help we've had from the state, said Almario. The residents club together to save money for community expenses. We do everything ourselves, including maintaining the trails and the attempt to build a road. We have many needs, but we have to do everything by horseback, Fortune said Kumako. Well, FARC has lost all support in these parts where locals want to, quote, change the constantly negative image, end quote, of their home. What is left of FARC in Magatalia is just the families of around 100 disarmed former guerrillas who live lower down the valley in a reincorporation village. Images of legendary FARC leader Manuel Tirofijo Marulanda and the red rose emblem of the commune's political party formed by ex-guerrillas after the peace accord donned the walls of houses in Magatalia. X-Fighters are now integrated in the area where, quote, other communities have accepted them, said a local merchant who requested anonymity. Now, some former FARC members want to turn Makatalia into a tourist attraction to share the history of the Marxist rebellion. It is not a popular idea in a village that wants to break from its past, but Almario acknowledges the subject should be discussed. Quote, if it helps bring in tourists and changes our image, then why not, he says. Very, very compelling story, to say the least. Now let's quickly look at some other things here. I think you'll find this very interesting. This is about women on the French left who are launching a hashtag MeTooPolitics. In an article published on Monday in French daily Le Monde, which means the world in French, nearly 300 prominent women called on leftist political parties to, quote, remove the perpetrators of sexual and gender-based violence, end quote, saying too many elected officials and candidates have been accused of wrongdoing. To the cinema, the media, and the sports milieu, it is now the political world's turn to be caught up by the, quote, hashtag MeToo movement. On November 15, 285 women working in politics and academia published an open letter in the daily newspaper Le Monde asking that, quote, the perpetrators of sexual and gender-based violence be removed from political office. Quote, we women working in politics, elected officials, collaborators, civil servants, community leaders, activists who regularly rub shoulders with politicians, but first and foremost citizens, call on the political world to provide a comprehensive response to sexual and gender-based violence committed by our representatives, they wrote. The signatories represent a wide spectrum of the left, including hard left MEP Manon Aubry, socialist senator and former women's affairs minister Laurence Rossignol, the Green Party's Sandra Rigaud, and Hélène Bidard, the deputy mayor of Paris and a member of the French Communist Party. So they question, when will we be freely heard? In Parliament, they write, town halls, departments, departmental and regional councils, men who have been accused, sometimes convicted of rape, sexual assault, sexual abuse of minors, and domestic violence get elected. Despite the rhetoric of the fight against violence against women, despite our repeated warnings, end quote, the women wrote. Once again, and on the eve of crucial elections for our country, we urge the political apparatus to listen to the victims and to work towards prevention, the signatories added. It is time for the political world to, quote, face up to its responsibilities, end quote, by removing, quote, the perpetrators of sexual and sexist violence from its ranks, end quote, and being careful about what kind of people it promotes, they wrote. The progress wrought by the hashtag MeToo movement has not gone far enough in the ranks of the political classes. Quote, women's speech has been liberated, but when will we be freely heard, end quote. Since the letter was published, the hashtag MeTooPolitics hashtag has spread on Twitter. Several internet users have posted messages recounting their attacks by politicians. Now, what's at the heart of the presidential election? In conjunction with the open letter, the women launched the website MeTooPolitique.fr, so MeTooPolitique.fr, which contains a three-point pledge against sexist and sexual violence in politics that they hope to see signed by elected officials and executives of political parties. The women plan to raise this issue throughout the presidential and legislative campaigns of 2022. In April of 2022, we will choose the President of the Republic. Three candidates or potential candidates for the Élysée Palace have already been accused of sexual assault. This does not prevent them from believing that they are worthy of occupying the Supreme Magistracy. Far from it. This shows how indifferent they are to the plight of women and victims, the women wrote in the letter. No names are given, but the daily newspaper Libération, which means liberation naturally, takes on the task, quote, "One thinks, of course, of far-right pundit Eric Zemmour, actual violence by several women, anti-Europe politician François Asselineau, another investigation for sexual assault, and independent National Assembly member Jean Lassalle, accused of sexual harassment by several women," end quote. With just days to go before the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, the signatories of the letter also called on people to join the marches being organized throughout France on November 20 by the Nous Toutes collective. This is the article was originally written in French, but we had to read it to you in English, because I don't know how many people actually listen to us in French, So, hey, this is the way it goes. Okay. So I think we're at the end of the line for us. Let's see. Tomorrow, we're going to be speaking to Oren M. Levin-Waldman, the socioeconomic researcher. I read the article to you, and we'll be discussing them. I'll be discussing it with him. We'll try to extrapolate more issues and concerns that he's brought up. It's very heavy stuff, and I'm a simple guy, and he's just a brilliant elaborator on these issues and concerns. Even the writing is very complex. This is probably one of the most complex issues I've seen him tackle, because he speaks also to, I think we've got an extremely intellectual follow him, but even so, and I'm not the dumbest one in the room, but I found the complexity of it all sometimes eclipsed even my capacity to comprehend. So I'm going to ask those questions because I don't fully comprehend everything that he said, and I know one thing is certain, that I would not be averse to learning what he really said. Because I may not have comprehended all of its complexity. And that's the purpose of living. And certainly when we have a gentleman like Oren M. Levin-Waldman permitting us to repost his work, it's just exceptional. It raises everybody who listens to us, who reads his work, to an unbelievable level. And I'm extremely thankful. I look forward to talking to him tomorrow. Well, that's the end of our time frame today. It probably is about another minute or so left, but we're going to say goodbye now. And we thank you most definitely for being with us. All the best to you, and goodbye. Okay, bear with me a second. Okay, we're going to log out now. So just have a great day, and thank you for being with us today. Goodbye.